Welcome to the Stew World Order. My name is Robert Stewart, and every single episode I bring on an outstanding guest with which to talk comic book movies. Behind the scenes of each episode, that guest and I have pulled three random movies from our comprehensive list of graphic novel cinema, and they've chosen the one that they want to present to you today. From there, we give the movie our ups and our downs, and our overall rating out of 10 to see which ones are true standouts in the field, and which ones are just riding the crest of the popularity wave. If you enjoy the Stew World Order, there's two things you simply must do, and the first is give it a 5-star review on your favorite podcast player. The second is to check out swoproductions.com, where we have new articles every single weekday, including first-time watch-throughs of classic television shows and deep dives into beloved franchises. You can also follow us on all the social media sites at SWO Productions. Now, before we get into the episode, one final shout out to the great band Punchline. They provide all the music for the show, and you can find more from them at their website, punchlion.com. Now enjoy this new episode of the Stew World Order. Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of the Stew World Order podcast, where we review random comic book and sometimes comic strip, I guess, movies with our guest. And our guest today is the absolute one and only, the inimitable Mark Wade. How are you today, sir?
I'm good, sir. And you? What kind of day has it been?
It's been a busy day. I had work this morning. I've been working all day, and now I'm getting ready to talk to you, and I'm very excited about it.
Copy that. All right. Terrific. Let's go.
All right. So first, I have to say, I spoke with you briefly at Kansas City. We met at Planet Comic Con. That's where I first asked you if you wanted to be on the show. I have to gush very quickly before we get into talking the Phantom. If it weren't for you, I don't know if I would still be reading comic books, because I read comics as a child. I read comics through my early teens, and then I hit that 16, 17, 18 year old phase where, you know, oh, I'm too old, sure, and too cool for this. But right when I had stopped reading, Kingdom Come had started coming out. And several years later, I was in college. I was about 19, 20 years old, and I went to a Walden Books. And just on a whim, I pulled Kingdom Come off the shelf. And I thought, I heard good things about this. I'll give it a buy. Kingdom Come changed comic books for me. It changed what comics were. I didn't know they could just be so powerful and so beautiful. And it's a story I go back to yearly. I read Kingdom Come at least once a year, and there are pages in that book that just give me goosebumps to this day every year that I read it. And before Kingdom Come, I wasn't a DC guy. I was a Marvel kid. I read Spider-Man, X-Men, stuff like that. It was reading Kingdom Come that turned me into a much bigger DC fan in my my college years, which coincidentally is when you were writing The Flash. So I got right into your work there, too. And, you know, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be reading DC. And who knows if I would have gotten back into comics at all. So just a thank you from me, just gushing, letting you know how much I appreciate your work.
No, I appreciate the appreciation. It's very nice of you to say. And, you know, with Kingdom Come, it's impossible to go wrong with Alex Ross at your side, obviously. That work is so beautiful and just so breathtaking. Neither of us could have predicted that, you know, nearly 30 years on, people would still be talking about it. But that's great to hear.
Yeah, and then it was your work on The Flash. It was your work on Mark Wade. It was your work on Chris Samnee's run on Daredevil. It was your contributions to 52, which is probably my second favorite comic story of all year. Wow. Or all time. 52 is a comic that, when I don't feel particularly inspired to write, I go back and reread 52 because it's so great. And I love how it handled all these minor characters in DC and made them important.
Thanks. That was the remit from editorial. It was, let's, you know, we can't use Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman. For those context, for those who are listening but don't know, 52 was a weekly comic book series co-written by Grant Morrison, Greg Rucka, Jeff Johns, and myself over the course of 52 issues at a time when Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman were doing something else. We were asked to elevate characters like Animal Man and Rip Hunter and Booster Gold and, you know, and so many others, Elongated Man, just make them interesting again. And I think we accomplished it for the most part.
Oh, you definitely did. These are characters that some of them I didn't know about, some I knew about, but didn't have immense passion for. And I read that series and just became a huge fan of these characters. I started following up what they were introduced to after 52, because after you guys elevated them so highly, they were obviously used a lot more in continuity going forward. And so I started reading, say, Dan Jurgens' run on Booster Gold, the 52 pickup, I think it was called, and everything like that.
Great. Glad to hear.
Well, let's talk about what you're doing now before we get into the movies. You're working on one of the books that I'm way behind on. I've read the first 7 issues of Batman and Superman's World's Finest. I keep hearing how it's talked about still in the 20, I think 27 was the most recent issue,
right,
that's come out.
27 just came out. 28 comes out in a week and a half, I think.
Okay. But it's constantly being talked about as one of the best books on the shelves, independent, Marvel, DC, what have you. It's being talked about as one of the best. Is it something that you pitched to DC, or did they come to you and say, hey, we want this new World's Finest book to start coming out?
At the time I'd first come back to DC, there was a current World's Finest book being published. And I'm not one for scalping anybody else's job. So I just told the editor, listen, if that book ever becomes available, I'd like to take it on. And then in no time at all, it became available, and we were able to relaunch it with an issue 1, Batman Superman World's Finest, with a different, two differences. One was that, unlike a lot of other World's Finest Superman Batman series, which were always tied into current continuity, which meant that you had to reflect what was not only try to tell a story, but also reflect what was going on in Superman and what was going on in Batman at the time. They asked, keep it not out of continuity, but set it in the near past. That way you have access to all the familiar Superman tools, like the Daily Planet and Clark having a secret identity and Clark not necessarily being married to Lois. And you have the Batman tools you have Alfred, who's still alive back then, Batcave, all that stuff. And that was the first difference. The second difference was when I brought to the book, which was Robin had not been a part. Dick Grayson and Robin had not been a part of these adventures. And I found pretty much by accident that putting Dick Grayson in the books along with Batman and Superman and making him a third player, not only opened up the stories, but just gave me somebody to be funny, you know, gave me somebody to be a little comic relief in there. So that was a godsend of a book. Dan Mora being the artist is really the secret sauce, is really the thing that makes that book sing. And I've been doing it for 2 years now, a little over 2 years. And if it were up to me, I'd do it to the end of time.
So do you prefer writing books that are modern tellings in the current canon, or do you prefer doing something that you can squeeze into a past and say, oh, this fits into continuity here, or it's not in continuity, just accept it as a story that takes place in an Elseworlds kind of thing?
I think more the latter. I mean, you don't want to tell stories that are perceived as Elseworlds or perceived as not in continuity, because fans don't take them seriously. The fans just look at them as, oh, this isn't important, or, oh, this doesn't matter. So right from the start with World's Finest, we have been set in the near past, but every story has had some sort of connection to what's going on in the DC universe today. So that was an important part of it to me, to make sure that people understood it, quote unquote, counted. So that's my preference.
Okay. Well, speaking of books that are in the canon that are definitely continuity, you are starting out on Absolute Power, the new big DC event story that follows the events of Beast World or Beast War?
Beast World.
Beast World. That's right. I have the first issue here of the special edition, nice little foil cover that I got. Big fan of the going back to the 90s with the fancy covers. It's very nostalgic for those of us that remember that era. What's going on in Absolute Power? As you see in the special edition here, it seems like it's going to focus around Amanda Waller, and she's doing a really big power grab to go after the heroes of the world. It's possible it's leading to some kind of future based on what we see the precog dream about. What can you tell us so far about what's going on in Absolute Power?
Well, I mean, throughout the DC universe, not just in the comics, but also in the TV shows and the movies, you know, we've been setting Amanda Waller up to be a real big bad for the heroes, somebody who genuinely believes that the chaos that they bring is not worth what they are able to accomplish for mankind, that it just humans are best left in the hands of humanity, if you will. So Absolute Power is her big play. Absolute Power is something she's been planning for years, and now she has the cards have fallen her way. She now has allied with Failsafe, who is a major Batman villain, and the Brainiac Queen, who is a major Superman villain. And between the three of them, they are able to do what no one else has ever done, which is basically throw a switch, basically sending power sapping androids out into the world and literally draining all of the heroes of their power, all the magicians of their magic, you know, using her knowledge of the hero's secrets to shut off their access to their, you know, their bat caves and their invisible planes and their, you know, their tools and their resources, so that they are completely without hope. They are completely without resource. And through the beauty of fake news AI, she has convinced ordinary people that superheroes have turned bad and are out to kill humanity. So they have nowhere to turn, nowhere to run, and Amanda has them right where they want them, where she wants them, rather.
Is this going to be a Justice League central book, or are there going to be other characters that are going to be really important through Absolute Power?
Oh, plenty of other characters that are going to be important. One of the things I asked for to make it clear that this was a event of significance was, can we directly cross over into Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, their own monthly comics, at the same time as we're doing this? You know, if you, with some of these events, if you're doing crossover books or tie-in books and they're B and C list books, it doesn't really feel like it has that same sort of gravitas. But if you're directly involving Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern, actually, as four series that are directly tying in, and you know, and that's what those characters will be doing in their own books, is dealing with the Absolute Power stuff, then it gives it some import. So all this to say, in issue two, everyone's sent out on missions. Superman, your job is to do this. Batman, your job is to do this. Wonder Woman, your job is to do this. And then that is what they are doing in their own series, right? That are side missions that will eventually come back to the climax of the story. But what that also means is that frees me up to not have to worry about what they're doing in the main book, and instead be able to concentrate on characters like Nightwing and Dreamer and John Kent and other, you know, those are not B-list characters necessarily. Some of them are, but drill down even further on old characters that nobody's ever heard of these days, like Airwave, that I get a chance to sort of see if I can elevate while Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are off doing their own thing.
Excellent. So how many issues is Absolute Power going to run?
There's a zero issue that comes out the end of this month that is basically set up. You don't have to read it to understand the series, but it will help you understand a little bit better who the main players are. That's Ground Zero that comes out the week before Absolute Power 1. Absolute Power is four issues beginning July 3rd and monthly thereafter.
Okay, excellent. Well, I will keep an eye out for that. Like I said, I have the special edition number one, which is beautiful, and it ends with Superman getting shocked, which he obviously doesn't expect, and falling out of the sky. So I don't imagine he's going to die, but we'll see what happens in the next issue.
We'll see what happens. I will also mention that Dan Mora is doing the artwork on this as well. So, you know, come for Absolute Power, stay for Dan Mora. I mean, he's a genius. Excellent. So he's going to make this thing shine.
Yes, absolutely. He's been a fantastic artist on Batman and Superman, the world's finest. The art in the special edition here is beautiful. So very excited to see more of his work also.
Yeah, me too.
All right, well, let's move over into the movie we're going to discuss today. When you pulled your three choices from the list, you had The Phantom, Marry Me, and The Hulk. Obviously, from the title, everyone knows we're going to be discussing The Phantom. What was your impetus for choosing that one out of those three?
I had to rule out Marry Me immediately because it's a really terrific movie with Owen Wilson and J-Lo, I believe.
Yes. And
the reason I'm ruling out is because John Rogers, who was the writer, is one of my best friends. So I was going to be biased right off the bat. And The Hulk, I haven't seen for quite a while. I remember enjoying it at the time, but I didn't really feel like I was terribly motivated to dive back into it. But The Phantom, I remember being sort of ambivalent about and haven't seen it since it came out in 1996. So that would be worth taking another look at.
Yeah, this was actually my first viewing. I missed The Phantom whenever it came out initially. I think it got some bad reviews, and that might have scared me away. Like you said, you were ambivalent, so maybe other people who aren't as passionate about the industry didn't give it quite as good reviews, so maybe I just kind of shied away from it whenever I was 15 years old. But this was my first viewing. Definitely a little bit better than I thought, but we'll start off with the ups and downs, as we usually do. And I will lead us off on the ups and say, there is some surprising brutality in this movie that I did not really expect for something that I thought was a kid's adventure movie. But you have two scenes in fairly short order somewhere in the middle of the movie where Treat Williams's character, Xander Drax, he blinds a librarian by getting him to accidentally stick razor blades in his own eye. That was intense for this movie. I did really not expect that. And then shortly thereafter, one of his gang leaders decides he doesn't want any part of what's going on. So Xander throws a spear and just gets him in the back and kills this guy with a spear. So I was surprised, given the level of viciousness that this movie was throwing at us.
I think there was a great deal of confusion among filmmakers in the wake of Batman 1989. As to how do we treat this material. On the one hand, they're spandex costume superhero figures, so they're fanciful and they appeal to children. On the other hand, we also want to make sure that our audience is not just children. So sometimes their solution to that was just to throw in a little bit of random violence for no real good reason, just something to elevate it, quote unquote, to a PG level.
Yeah, it's just different than very recently I did The Rocketeer for an episode. Right. And I watched The Rocketeer. It's a Disney movie. It's a whimsical set in the past adventure movie just like this is. But it doesn't have anything about people getting their eyes gouged
out. No. So, it's straight up 1930s style adventure stuff. Yeah.
And it was just a lot different than what I expected going into this. I was expecting for something very much like The Rocketeer, and you get something, obviously not hardcore would be the right word, but something a little bit more violent than I was expecting. And I guess after The Rocketeer, it was just a nice juxtaposition to watch something like this instead, which I like The Rocketeer. I don't mean to be besmirching that movie. It was just a different atmosphere.
I think people in general like the memory of Rocketeer more than they actually like Rocketeer.
Oh, I know people who love the memory of the Rocketeer.
Exactly. I would never want to harsh their mellow by making them go back and watch it again. it wasn't a bad movie. I remember distinctly just going in with expectations and walking out of it thinking that was a perfectly fine movie, but there was nothing I remember. Nothing stuck to me a month later. There was not one single clever line of dialogue that I remember. Not one quotable scene where you come out of the movie theater and you go, gosh, you remember that part where this happened to your friends and you're all excited? I don't remember that being there at all. I mean, the performances were great. The look of it was amazing. I'm glad that Disney did it. And I would never in a million years want to, as they say, you know, harsh on anybody who really dug it. But I found that people who talk about loving it also have not seen it since they saw it as children.
Yeah, no, I think I could agree with that. I think whenever I saw it this time, that was pretty much what my opinion was like, this is fine. This is good.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into what is your first up for the Phantom?
Billy Zane is my first up for the Phantom. I mean, as the title character, he's great. He's charming. He's funny. He's, you know, he looks like a superhero. And I even remember at the time I was watching it thinking, there is a world in which this guy should be playing Superman on screen somewhere. He has the twinkle in his eye. He has the grin. He's got the attitude. And there's nothing about him that is not lovable in this. Like, if nothing else, if you take everything else away from this movie, it's worth watching just for him.
Yeah, he's got a great voice, too. I could see him really empowering Superman with his voice.
Yeah.
I just recently watched Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight, where he plays the titular Demon Knight in that movie. And he is so much fun chewing the scenery as this evil demon who's out trying to kill this hotel full of people. And yeah, he's so much fun. He was a big up for me in this movie, too. I always get a blast out of seeing him. And I feel like we need more Billy Zane nowadays. Bring Billy Zane back.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. I'll go into my second up here and say a lot of this movie is very Indiana Jones-esque. Yep. So if you like the Indiana Jones style adventure, you've got the whole bridge sequence early in the movie where he's trapped on the rope bridge going across the big cavern and there's the river below him. And he's got this child with him that he's trying to save, and they end up swinging across the bridge. It just reminded me of, I think, Temple of Doom.
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, it did, okay, but I don't know if you'd count this as a plus or a minus. On the upside to that was it was a great scene. The downside to it is I've seen it before, and I saw it before, twice before. It's stolen directly from a movie called The Wages of Fear.
Okay.
From the mid-60s, a black and white foreign film where the entire movie is about getting a truck like that across the jungle, and it's filled with nitroglycerin. That's the whole gimmick of the movie. And there's a whole scene in the movie that is the most, you know, the most memorable part of it is doing that exact same thing, is driving a truck across a rotted old rope bridge slowly and trying to get there. It was remade by William Friedkin as the movie Sorcerer in the 70s. Okay. And that scene is also not as good, but it's that scene's in there as well. So I like that scene, but I was thinking, gosh, I wish we'd started with something that wasn't
a that's fair
knockoff of something that was, something that I'd already seen twice.
I understand. I get that. I haven't seen those movies, so it's a little bit new to me still. So at least there's that. But I get what you're saying. If I never see another action movie where people are falling out of an airplane and fighting in the air and things they fall, if I never see that scene again, it'll be too soon. All right, round us out on the ups. What is your last up for the Phantom?
My up is it felt like straight up Saturday afternoon serial. I say this, I was never, not old enough to go to the movies and see Saturday afternoon serials, but it very much felt, as you say, in that Indiana Jones spirit. And again, Billy Zane's attitude was charming. Treat Williams was a decent mustache twirling villain. And there's a great scene in there where the Phantom is chasing the kidnapped heroine by leaping over taxi cabs and making his way through 1930s New York traffic. That's just fun to watch.
Yeah, I get you on Treat Williams. Like, he's another guy chewing scenery in his role, and he really seems to be just having a lot of fun just playing this unabashedly evil Xander Drax.
Right. On the other hand, Patrick McGowan is in a completely different movie altogether. Patrick McGowan is playing the ghost of the Phantom's father, and that plays into the whole history of the strip. I mean, it's been around since the 1930s. I want to say not 20s, 30s. And the whole conceit is that the Phantom is an identity that is passed from father to child, sometimes daughter, along the family lineage to perpetuate the notion of this being an immortal hero of the jungle. So Patrick McGowan plays his dad. It's first, it seems like dad's still around. Then we realize dad's a ghost, which is cute. But then Billy Zane is standing in the middle of the street talking to him, and other people are staring at him, trying to figure out what the crazy guy's doing. That's a little weird. And Patrick McGoohan is a treasure. I mean, he's an absolute treasure. He is he's the second greatest Columbo villain of all time. And he was amazing on The Prisoner, and he's always good in anything. But this one felt like he was just in a completely different movie.
Yeah, he's taking it a little too seriously with his lines of dialogue. He's not radiating the joy that everybody else on screen is.
Right.
I'll get into the downs here and say, I know this is an adventure movie. I know it's not an action movie. I'm not watching The Phantom and expecting John Wick or anything.
Right.
But the fight choreography in this could have been better, I thought. It's some lazy punches and some neat little judo flips. It's nothing really that sticks with you. I didn't watch this movie and remember like, oh, this great action sequence, or whenever the Phantom fought this guy, wasn't it really visually stunning? It's just kind of there. Whereas you come out of movies like Back to Indiana Jones, you remember sequences like that. You remember the punches thrown and the quippy dialogue that he has with the villains. And that's really lacking here.
Yes, I would have to agree. But I can't believe you haven't asked me who the first most excellent Columbo villain is. But
oh, well, by all means, who is the first most excellent Columbo villain?
Here's your list, and I will die on this hill. Greatest Columbo villain, Jack Cassidy. Second greatest villain, Patrick McGoohan. Third greatest villain, Robert Culp. Everyone else in a distant tie for last.
Distant tie. I've never seen Columbo. I've never honestly seen an episode of Columbo.
You are missing something. In all seriousness, it's streaming all over the place. I think it's on TikTok right now. The very first episode, which is directed by Steven Spielberg.
Oh, okay. I was unaware of that.
Called Murder by the Book. It's 90 minutes, which means it's like 75 minutes without commercials. A great watch. And I think that may turn you into a fan, depending upon what your normal tastes are.
Okay, I promise you I will watch at least the first episode of Columbo.
Yeah, you will not be sorry.
All right, excellent. Well, lead us off with your downs. What do you have for your first down for The Phantom?
As charming as he was, his quirkiness was a little off-putting. There was an attempt to make him a little weird. Not weird, scary, or creepy, but just super quirky and sort of not great with people. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but he's just bizarre. That's the word. He's just a little bizarre in his human dealings with other people. That was one of the downs.
He was too confident, I found. Like, even when he was the Phantom, he just had this presence of always knowing what was going on, and it diminished from my feeling he was ever in any sense of peril, because the character didn't seem to think he was ever in trouble, so why would I think he was ever in any trouble?
Right.
I'll get over into my second down here and say Christy Swanson as Diana was fine. Christy Swanson is her own thing these days, of course. But the character starts off seeming like she might be in an empowered female character. She decks Catherine Zeta-Jones. She's punching bad guys. But then as the movie goes on, she just becomes the typical damsel in distress from the 1930s era. And you would hope a movie that came out in 1996 would subvert that somewhat and have her be a little bit more self-motivated and action-oriented. But it doesn't. She just gets abducted by Xander Drax and the Phantom has to come along and save her. And I was hoping she could be not just a damsel.
You're exactly right. Like, they set her up in the first act to be, you know, her own woman and a hard driving, hard fighting companion to the Phantom. But boy, she very quickly just folds into, you know, milk toast, as you say, damsel in distress, which is just unfortunate. But then again, God, I hope Christy Swanson isn't listening to this. I don't know what you're going to get out of her as a performer. She is so outclassed by everyone around her. She's not terrible.
No,
but she doesn't. I mean, she's up against Catherine Zeta-Jones. I mean, that's somebody who is magnetic on screen. So that's part of the problem, isn't it? The two, anytime, and you do in the back third of the movie, have the two of them sharing a lot of screen time. Well, you're looking at Catherine Zeta-Jones. She just pulls your eye, not just in attractiveness, but I mean, in terms of on stage, you know, charisma, on screen presence. And so that doesn't do Chrissy Swanson any favors.
No, like, you're right. Catherine Zeta-Jones is absolutely magnetic. You just follow her because she has the look in her face where you always are trying to figure out what she's up to in this movie. So, yeah, you're watching her, whereas Christy Swanson, like you said, very milquetoast in this movie. She's just kind of there.
Yeah.
All right. Finish us off on the downs. What do you have?
It's a minor thing, but having rewatched it again just a very short time ago, I cannot remember a note of the soundtrack.
And, oh, okay.
And that's something I look for in a big adventure movie is, you know, a little bit of soundtrack that I can remember, from the Batman to the Superman to the Avengers to any of those, you know, Captain America. They all have themes and motifs. And this was just, it felt lacking. I don't even remember who the composer is. And I normally pay attention to those things in a heroic movie.
I thought the score worked during the scenes, but you're right, as soon as the score was over, I wasn't humming it. I didn't remember it. It just felt like generic adventure movie theme number 7.
Yeah, not a note do I remember. Yep.
Yeah.
These spells are more powerful than I ever imagined. I've harnessed the energy of the sun. Who needs a fourth skull?
I do, and I know where it is. I've worn it all my life. For protection. I never really understood what that meant until right now.
Ha! What a cheap jungle trick!
Okay, we talked the ups and the downs of the Phantom. We're going to go ahead and give it our score out of 10 and why, and I will kick us off again and say this is probably a 5.5 for me out of 10. It's a little bit on the plus side of average for me. It's fine. It's enjoyable. At an hour and 40 minutes, it doesn't overstay its welcome or anything. I could see nowadays, if you made this movie, they would stretch it out to 2 hours just because they could, just to turn it into a summer blockbuster. But this movie knows how long it needs to be, and it hits that target. Like you said, Billy Zane is just incredible in this. I got a blast out of seeing him, had a lot of fun, but it's a movie that I'll probably never watch again, and I worry that in a month I'll have forgotten 95% of it. So yeah, it's a good watch, but not particularly memorable or outstanding in any way.
No, it really is for a bored, rainy Saturday afternoon when there's really nothing else that catching your attention. Most people, you know, if given a chance, I would just go back and watch, you know, another superhero movie. But it was, I'd give it a solid 6 out of 10, in part because I do feel like it's a little above average. There's nothing about it that just outright sucked. And Billy Zane was, again, really worth the watch. And as you say, it knew when to end. I mean, nothing makes me more frustrated than modern movies that are 3 hours long, that are just, you know, the audience is fishing for its keys 15 minutes before the movie, for the credits roll. And so this was not that.
Absolutely. All right, Mr. Wade, thank you so much. We had pretty similar opinions there. I think we really nailed the Phantom. It's a little bit above average. Watch it if you get a chance, but don't expect to have your socks knocked off.
Exactly.
But slam evil, because that's a great slogan.
That's a slogan.
All right. Before we get you out of here, let everybody know where they could find you online, on the social medias. You're a great guy to interact with. I love everything you have to say. Others, maybe they don't, but we don't like those people. I like you. I like exactly, what you have to say. I like what you stand up for.
Thank you.
You're the kind of person I want writing Superman, because I know what you stand for.
Thank you. Yeah. If you're a racist, misogynist, problem guy who has a problem with LGBTQ people, I'm not the person you should be following. But yeah, you can find me on markwade.com is my website, which is not nearly updated nearly as often as it ought to be. You can find me on Blue Sky. You can find me on Instagram, Mark Wade Writer, I think, because some other idiot took the name Mark Wade, and it may even have been me, and I've lost the password. I don't know. Because I'm old, you can find me on Facebook. I ran screaming from Twitter a while back, so that's where you can find me.
All right. Well, thank you again so much. I really appreciate your time. I know you're a busy man, so thank you for coming on and knocking out the Phantom with me.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right. And until next time, everybody, take care.